Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Medical Minds Conversations with Guthrie Experts. I'm Steve Ostrous, as always, joined by Dr. Corinne Johnston. And today, super important topic. I know we say all the time, screenings save lives, this treatment saves lives. But today we're talking about Donate Life Month, which is the month of April. So we're literally talking about saving lives. So Dr. Johnston, I know you have some of the numbers that kind of really speak to how valuable it is to have organ donors.
When you look at the numbers, Steve, it's almost astounding, you know, from a national perspective. So there are more than 100,000 people awaiting an organ transplant across our nation. That looks like 17 people dying per day that won't receive a transplant. So almost 20 people a day because of that need for organ sharing. And then one organ donor can save 8 people. If you think about by the numbers, that's a lot. So if we can increase those donors, we certainly could have a really positive outcome.
And I was also reading that a new person is added to that national list approximately once every 10 minutes.
Yeah.
So that's staggering. In the time that people are going to be listening to this podcast, there could be 3, 4, or 5 more names added. So it's extremely important for us to talk about this today.
Steve, today with us, we have some very, very important people that have great messages to share with us on our podcast. So I'm going to start and introduce them both. So Dr. Adam Breslin is a dual board certified physician in both emergency medicine and critical care. Dr. Breslin also is the medical director of the organ donation support team. So brings a lot of color to our conversation today. And we're also lucky enough to have Dave Webster here with us today. And Dave is an organ donor recipient and really open to sharing his story with us. So welcome to you both.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Of course.
Dr. Breslin, I'd like to start off by asking you a question, and it's really talking about that organ donation support system, you know, and our affiliation with CORE. And for those who don't know, it's the Center for Organ Recovery and Education. But could you talk a little bit about that partnership and the need for the support system and how that kind of all works?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a fascinating. So there wasn't really a streamlined system. I would say CORE does really an extensive and incredible job behind the scenes. They're based out of Pittsburgh. When there is a potential organ donor, say for either, you know, someone's been declared brain dead or, you know, has some sort of terminal illness, there's many, many options for family members and loved ones, of course, during, you know, one of the hardest times of their lives, as you can imagine. But they help guide. They're a third party organization that really helps determine whether there's another option. Here at Guthrie, what we had noticed in my work as an ICU attending, there wasn't, I would say maybe some opportunity for streamlining the services and really helping coordinate. And so we kind of organically put together what we call the organ donation support team. So CORE works in conjunction with Guthrie. Primarily, the patients are out of the intensive care unit, whether that's in the medical ICU, the cardiac ICU, or the surgical trauma ICU. And then essentially, what really we noticed, and this was probably earlier, this is very new, probably within October or November of this past year, there wasn't really a good delineation. And you can imagine there's a lot of need for services to support the organ donation process, but also there's some ethical and moral challenges as well. So there really needed to be some delineation of services so that if a patient was, you know, potentially say declared brain dead on the surgical trauma ICU, who then could help, you know, navigate the difficulties and then the process, I'll say, of organ donation and working closely with, we do also work with pastoral care, palliative medicine, and then really having an intensive care team separate from what we would consider the primary team or the patient care team to help kind of coordinate that. Oftentimes there's a lot of diagnostic things that need to be done prior to even see if a patient is a candidate for a possible organ procurement. So that kind of grew organically because really we noted that there was a lot of opportunities, potential options, but there just wasn't really that service. So that kind of grew out of that. And CORE is really kind of really partnered well with us. And so we're, you know, for a rural area, we do cover a very large geographic area. So we actually have a pretty large catchment area in patients, and oftentimes very, very sick patients are coming to Robert Packer for services. So that kind of grew, you know, out of need, to be honest.
And what was your interest, Dr. Breslin? What kind of, you said as a critical care attending, you saw these things, but what really led you to have that passion about organ donation?
Sure. Yeah, it's kind of a funny story. I actually kind of fell into it. But I moved to the area in 2022. And just part of, you know, meeting my community, I was actually invited by my neighbor, who is a physician at Arnett, Dr. Alex Rupik, who took part in a golf charity golf tournament every year, and was just trying to get me involved in the community. And it was a charity which is called Forever 26. It actually benefits and recognizes Billy Lowe, the family of Billy Lowe, and the Donate Life organization. It was an incredible story that moved me beyond anything I could compare. And it was really, really powerful. So essentially, Billy was, an honor student, an incredible athlete in both ice hockey and lacrosse. Both sports are very, very close to my heart as well. Having a son involved in both of them, being in the Horseheads community as well, as I kind of grew and learned and became part of the small community, I learned of his story. And really, you know, Billy at the age of 15 passed away in 2020 while he was actually training on rollerblades for his ice hockey time. And it was incredibly moving because we actually met one of the recipients of Billy's kidneys. And I spoke to the family, who's Eddie Lowe, his father, is actually still really involved in the ice hockey community. And it was, I still get chills to this day, the parallels between Billy's family and my family, having a son who's now 9 playing lacrosse and ice hockey. And that really was a nidus to my passion. Prior to that, I was, a registered organ donor, on my driver's license, but really hadn't been presented an opportunity to really affect change. And then as I, was working as an ICU attending, I noticed that this was an incredible opportunity and something that I was extremely passionate about after that.
Yeah.
I think we're going to have a really hard time fitting everything into this episode because just some of the stories are just going to be really compelling. Speaking of stories, we want to bring in Dave, who is, a living example of exactly what organ donation can do. So, Dave, if you could just tell us a little bit about your story and, as a recipient.
Yeah, well, I taught ceramics and art at high school in Athens here. And I'm also a potter, and I was at a Letchworth show in State Park, and I started, I think that was the first time I started feeling heart failure. I suffered from heavy, hard to breathe, just normal cold symptoms. I continued to do the show. I struggled packing up. I got home. I went to work on Monday. After Monday, I suffered the same symptoms. I finally went to the ER. When I got to the ER, they did an echo, and they said my heart was pumping at 15% when it needs to be at 85%. So I was pretty confident with Guthrie. My father-in-law just beat cancer 5 times. So I says, okay, what do you got to do? And they went along and they gave me a heart cath and they found nothing. And somewhere along the line, I was given heparin, and I'm allergic to heparin, and they didn't know that. And when you're allergic to heparin, you start to clot. And so they put me on a balloon pump and they put me on the transplant list, a very long transplant list. And they flew me out to Cleveland Clinic, and out at Cleveland Clinic, things got really bad. To the fact where they were just trying to get all the clots out. They had me open from here to here, and it was, I think, about a 12 or 13 hour surgery. And finally, I got out of surgery, and I was in bad shape. And they called my family in and told them that, well, he's on life support machines, and he has only a week to be on these machines. And after that, we're going to have to take them off the machines. And a heart comes in once every, what, 8 weeks so that for chances of me getting a perfect match or getting a heart at all were very slim. And the third day I got my heart. I got my miracle, my gift of life, my second chance.
Could you talk a little bit about the donor and how this all came to be?
Yeah, this is Matthew. Matthew's my donor. And, you know, after I received my heart, I struggled with the fact that why is a 27-year-old gone? And here a 55-year-old is still here. It was then, you know, that I got some folks visited me from CORE. And it wasn't long after that that I became a volunteer. You know, Matthew, when he passed away, Chris told me, Chris's mother, so they gathered around Matthew's table. And as he passed away, the nurses and doctors gathered hands and said a prayer for Matthew and said, thank you for being a hero. And, you know, he is my hero. And I do everything I do for CORE is in his honor. And it's given me great therapy. And I hope passing my word on to kids at high schools that I can convince them to do the same and you know, check that box, become an organ donor.
Yeah, so you speak at high schools? That's part of your volunteering?
Yeah. It's, you know, I enjoy going to the high schools. I was a teacher at one time and I retired 10 years ago, and it's good to get back in and talk to kids. And, you know, when I go to these presentations, I usually have a bunch of videos and I let them know that this is a tough subject matter. Mm-hmm. It's not only about death and dying, but it's about hope and recovery and renewal. And as they see the videos and they see the stories of so many individuals that have lost a loved one but has been able to heal through organ donation, they start getting the picture and they say, you know, this is something I want to do. You know, I'm a caring person. And they, you know, a lot of them have said, what am I going to do with my organs after I pass away anyhow? And, you know, it's not a hard sell for them to sign up to be an organ donor. They were able to listen to the, watch the video of Chris listening to my heart. And she's an amazing woman. She looked up at me and said, you know, thank you for letting him live on. And Matthew saved not only my life, but he saved three others when he passed.
I think there's not a dry eye on the podcast listening, and these well, are the, at least
the video is quite compelling because it's yeah. Jamie comes in and listens to it. Jamie is a brother, and you know, when I was able to meet Chris and Jamie, it was hard at first, but she was so thrilled to see me, and so I mean, she's there with her stethoscope when I first met her, and it was neat to watch the video. There was even a hummingbird that came by and it flew and watched us both as she's listening to the heart. She just says, oh my God, this is so cool. And Jimmy was hard to listen to it at first because they were such good friends. And, you know, he lost his best friend and he lost his dad not soon before that. And this was a family struggling, but he was so into listening to the video that he, you know, he says, well, maybe I can hook it up to a mic, you know, maybe I can, you know, find some way of recording it. And, you know, and my wife stepped in and says, we got a present for you. And we came over to the Guthrie here and they were able to record the heartbeat and put it on a little teddy bear, which was pretty neat. And he went to bed with that teddy bear and he was able to listen to his brother's heart, which was pretty neat. And he kept saying, the beat goes on, because Matthew was a drummer. And, you know, he wrote this little autobiography about his life and it was entitled The Beat Goes On. So as you know, we sat there and listened to all of our similarities. My wife is a teacher and I'm a teacher and Matthew's mother's a teacher. Matthew's father's a teacher. Matthew loves music. I love music. Jimmy and I, to this day, we call each other and we talk about bands and so on and so forth. But, you know, it's funny, as she lost a family member, she gained many others, not only me, but another family member in New Jersey and one in Cleveland. But when these days come about in April, it's harder and harder when I go in to talk to, it's not hard, but when I go to talk to the students, you bring up all these emotions and, but at the same time, it's really important and I'm glad I do it.
I don't know what you're talking about, Dr. Johnson. It's just dusty in here. That's all. That's the only problem.
I was going to say, you've got two seasoned people here that deal with end of life quite a bit. And I don't think it ever gets easier.
No, it doesn't. I know some videos that I show that I've seen them 30 or 40 times and it still gets me,
Yeah.
But it's common, I guess. It's normal. But it's important.
Yeah. I think it is. And Dr. Breslin, Dave helps us a lot on kind of when you're the recipient's family, when you're someone who is losing that loved one, what's that like? Like, what is that process? What if you have a loved one that is an organ donor?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's incredibly bittersweet is probably the best word for it, because it really is heart-wrenching. Obviously, you're talking about end of life, and that's part of the reason why we really wanted to delineate also just in the ICU, the primary team, aggressively trying to get someone better, but when it does look like they either have progressed to brain death or they're not going to be able to recover from their critical illness, to have a separate team that can then come in, both from medical and palliative medicine perspective and social work and pastoral services, because it is really hard to navigate, right? End of life issues are a large area of what we cover in the ICU. Mm-hmm. But, oftentimes you're kind of faced with almost the least of all bad options, right? If mm-hmm. your loved one's not able to recover from their multi-organ failure or respiratory illness or head injury, what then? So we kind of help, at least from the ICU perspective, we help guide the families through. And then it really ultimately we leave the, a lot of the discussions initially to the core representatives, because if mm-hmm. a patient is identified early that they may be potentially not recoverable from their terminal illness, a core representative will fly in. They'll speak with the family, because again, we really want, we don't want there to be, there's a potential for gray area, right? You can imagine me, if I'm their primary ICU attending, I don't want to, I'm trying to get your loved one better, but then also there's another option, right? So I think having that's one thing that really helped us, because I know even myself, when I'm taking care of critically ill patients, it's incredibly, I'll say, ethically challenging, morally challenging, right? Mm-hmm. Even just the procurement process sometimes, we're trying to do things to get patients better. And then, oh, by the way, now we're doing something different. So, the working with the donor families is incredibly rewarding, but also I would say can be challenging. It's tough. We help navigate that process. Mm-hmm. We talk with the, once the family has made the decision, oftentimes the patient themselves has already designated themselves as an organ donor, on their license, or they have a living will or mm-hmm. other things that helps kind of help the family, but sometimes they don't. So family mm-hmm. members are left as the patient's voice and having to decide, we start having conversations about compassionate extubation, removing a breathing tube, stopping mm-hmm. the ventilator, what we call comfort measures, so allowing them a natural death. And then, if core has spoken to them and organ procurement or donation becomes a possibility, then we help navigate that process. So it's very similar to what we would do at end of life in the ICU. But mm-hmm. the process then is end of life in the operating room. And so it's basically we change our environment, specifically in like a donation after cardiac death, or what we call DCD. So we help navigate them. Family is still very intimate in that process. So we do an honor walk, which is one of my, mm-hmm. I don't want to say favorite, that's a bad word, but it's really one of the best parts mm-hmm. of the whole process, where all the family members are there. Staff and physicians, nurses, techs line the hallways, and they honor the the donor. You know, they basically go from the ICU to the operating room. And, you know, we play music. We, the families often video. They had something, it's an incredible celebration of life in a very sad time. And then we allow a small number of family members to actually be in the operating room with us. So it's as if we're doing, you know, you can imagine end of life care in the ICU, but instead in the operating room. So myself or one of the other organ donation support team members, who's a physician or a nurse practitioner or advanced practice provider, will accompany and it'll be with the primaries, the nurse as well. And it's just kind of a change of venue. But we help navigate the family, navigate that course with the family. And that's one of part of the reasons why we dedicated a team to it, because it's a lot of multidisciplinary care.
It's so nice that their life is celebrated, like you said, because they're obviously doing something so amazing. And I had no idea that the family was also allowed into the operating room to be part of that process. So that's fascinating. And I'm assuming that really, I mean, as much as one can be helped, helps the process a little bit for those grieving family members.
Yeah, it really does. And it's an incredible, because you talk a lot about the gift of life. And then they're there as their loved one, you know, passes away peacefully. And it's an incredibly powerful experience. I know a lot of nurses and physicians aren't part of that, you know, the dying process. But at the same time, it's the gift of life. And so it can be incredibly challenging, because you're there with a patient at the last minutes to seconds of their life, with the family members. And it's an incredible privilege. It is difficult. But yeah, it's an amazing thing to see the family members, there in the operating room. And it's really like one big family. And you know, we're celebrating the life of one, and you know, a gift of potentially, in Dave's case, multiple family or multiple patients' lives that were saved by one person.
Yeah.
So, could you? I'm assuming too that. Boy, it's so hard. I want to hear so much from both of you. So Dave, we'll jump back to you for a moment. Could you talk about, so you obviously find out that, you know, 3 days into the process that, you know, a heart has arrived. But talk about, you know, and you've talked about all of what you've done since then, the volunteering, but the process itself, you know, once you had the transplant and the conversations you were having with your wife or your family, once that process was complete, I imagine that had to be, I don't even know how to explain it.
A lot of this happened so quick. Usually when you're on a transplant list, it could be months before you receive it. And I didn't know all this. I mean, mine happened so fast that I was flown out to Cleveland before I knew what was going on. And when I came out, I could hear my wife whispering to me, "Dave, you have a new heart." And I didn't even realize I needed a new heart. So things happened so fast. And then I got the recovery. I was in Cleveland for a little over a month, and it usually doesn't take that long for a transplant. But I finally got to the hallway, and I was able to walk around a little bit. And I was really happy because I was recovering. And my wife turned to me and says, you know, we might want to tone it down a little bit, because everybody on this floor is waiting for that gift. And you passed every one of them. And to that point, I said, you know, I keep thinking back to that. And I says, well, you know, I'm not going to leave those folks behind. I'm going to try and keep doing what I can to get the word out. And right then, I made it, you know, part of my life. And, you know, it's interesting that when Dr. Breslin was talking about, you know, that Matthew wasn't signed up to be a donor. Chris stepped in, so a nurse had to go in and doctors had to go in there and convince this poor woman, you know, there's some people that really, you know, are dying. Would you like to, you know, donate his organs? And she says, yeah, this is something Chris would have wanted. Matthew would have wanted. He's a very caring person. He would have, this by all means, she made that perfectly clear. And then when I go to these schools and I talk to kids, I challenge them to not only, you know, if they want to be a donor, to talk to their folks about it. And I even take it a step further and ask them if they are a donor or if their friends are donors. And then they get a discussion going about, you know, well, I don't want to become a donor because if the doctors find out that I'm a donor, they're not going to save my life. And then I says, well, that's ridiculous, because any doctor out there is going to do everything possible to save the individual's life. And they don't even know that you're a donor, for starters. And there's so many myths that are brought up that can be rebutted in just a minute, you know. And it's just amazing how people will argue against one thing or another. But, you know, if you don't want to do it, that's fine. But I try and give them all the information so that they can, you know, when they go to get their license, they're just not clicking a box or not clicking a box, because it might take a second or two. But just to give them that information and let them know and talk and discuss to their folks about it and say, this is really what I want to do.
Yeah. And I think, Dave, you're the, you know, you're the penultimate, right? Like the heart. I think, you know, we hear about hearts a lot. We hear about kidneys a lot. But Dr. Breslin, there are a lot of things that can be donated. I think maybe one of those myths is that you have to be a healthy, you know, teenager or 20-something to be able to save a life.
Yeah, yeah, it's incredible. So, I mean, you know, obviously heart gets a lot for rightful reasons, right? It's, you know, especially so that it can live on and you can hear someone's heartbeat. But I mean, oftentimes, I'm just trying to think back in the cases this year. I mean, there's potential to donate lungs, liver, pancreas, kidneys, and then beyond organs, even tissues. You know, you can imagine ligaments, people that, you know, may not be able to walk, right? They get, you know, a recipient's, you know, ACL or especially corneas. That is also another one where patients who may not be able to see can be given the gift of sight. So there's all sorts of other things. And even if it's not directly donated to a recipient, there's a lot of research as well. So nothing, you know, if you're donating yourself as a gift, there's a lot of other things. And that's one of the other things that the core representatives help. I think both the donor and recipient's families. And after every case, we always get a letter of what was, you know, potentially donated and what was recoverable and things. And it's incredible. You know, sometimes it's two pages of different things that were, you know, save someone's ability to walk, save someone's ability to see. And, you know, now they're no longer dialysis dependent. And it's really incredible.
Yeah. And that's passed along and shared with the family too.
Correct.
That letter. Yeah. So, you know, your loved one. Yeah.
Yeah. Cause it's some moving. Of it is even not as immediate. I mean, obviously we often know within the time of the OR, cause there's certain specifications if they pass away within a specific time that certain organs may not be able to be utilized if they're beyond a time. After the resolution of the case, everyone that was part of it will know. And oftentimes it may take a little while because they'll have the opportunity to donate tissues and different things like that. So usually I would say a couple weeks after or even a week, we know, and it's incredible to see. It's, you know, and that's sent out to the families, and, you know, they help create that amazing network that Dave was talking about and the connections. And I think that's also vitally important because people see that the gift continues to give.
Yeah.
Talk about the process about signing up. I know we briefly touched on it, and I think the part that I think most people know or at least heard about, like, oh, it's you put it on your driver's license. Is that the only way? Are there other ways? What is the process of signing up to become an organ donor?
Yeah, so it depends. One, state by state, things are different, but you can obviously, the easiest way is to check a box. That doesn't automatically mean that you qualify. You know, there's a lot of other things as far as diagnostic and finding a match. Like, you know, Dave, I'm sure, recognizes how incredibly fortunate, right, to be able to find a match within 3 days. I mean, that's, you know, exceedingly rare. A lot of folks will spend a lot of time on the transplant list, and folks can even pass away waiting for a donor. But the process itself, oftentimes, as Dave was mentioning, either a conversation is had typically it's with the patient's family members, because the patient is usually critically ill. And it depends kind of on their diagnosis. Brain death in itself is a separate diagnosis. So they're actually, when the diagnosis of brain death is made, the patient's actually considered dead at that point, for legal terms, even if their body is still alive. So that is often navigated by the core representatives themselves. And there's a lot of other options. There's things like a living will. Being an ICU, I'm a little bit biased, but I encourage everyone to have a living will and also a MOLST or a PULSE form. So that's the life-sustaining orders. You know, things like DNR, DNI, code status, having those conversations, they're very hard to have, but I think incredibly important. And it's funny, even when I just became involved in the process, I've kind of been, you know, tell your loved ones what you would or would not want, because oftentimes family members are faced with these really hard decisions. And we do our best to help navigate them with them, but you know, it's tough, especially, you know, sometimes we're fortunate because the patients themselves have been very clear with what they wanted, and other times not. So there's folks to help navigate that, certainly palliative medicine as well and social work. But I would say by far and away, usually it's through a living will or someone has done something where they've they've designated a power of attorney or things like that, someone that's decision maker. And that's oftentimes the same person as the healthcare proxy, but sometimes different. So we have to navigate that as well. And the healthcare proxy makes the decisions for the patient if they're not able to make those decisions for themselves, if that helps answer your question.
And this is your plug that if you've done that paperwork, take it in your primary care doctor so they can put it in your medical record, right? So God forbid you would ever end up in Dr. Breslin's ICU. It's right there for him.
Yeah, there you go, Dr. Johnson. A big plug for primary care. It's incredibly important. I don't think patients, our loved ones, take time enough to do it. And it's really, really important.
I'm glad you called her out because I noticed that circle around back to primary care as well. Just, I think we both caught that. So I think, I want to go back and ask you, Dave, you've both touched on this indirectly and directly, but if you could give, that person who's thinking about it, maybe they're listening or watching this podcast, your message as to why it's so vitally important to consider organ donation.
Well, I guess it's just one of those things of empathy, I guess. When you pass away, you're not going to use your organs. The healing that occurs for your family members that are left behind. Think of those folks it's just as I talked to Chris, she felt so much comfort and so much closure, and the fact that she was able to save someone else's life through her decision and Matthew's decision, it's very important. I don't know if I can put it into words how important, but it's given that second life, that second gift. How's the saying go? Don't go to heaven with your organs. Heaven knows we need them here. I think that's the best way to say it.
Well said.
I was going to say to you, I think putting a face to it, right? Like looking at Dave, and I think maybe one of those myths might be that people that need organ transplants landed there because of their own choices. And I think hearing Dave's story that, you just were doing your normal daily thing.
So many times people say, kids will say, well, I'm not going to donate my organs to someone that didn't take care of theirs. And that I'll bring that up at high schools and talk about vaping and, about folks that need to be on a transplant list because they're vaping. And of course, the health teacher's pointing at certain kids or looking at certain kids. Other kids actually are looking at other kids. It's not the health teacher, but it's only happens about 5% where people do not take care of their organs. Or on it, and they've got to come clean. I mean, they've got to, if they're looking for a liver, they get blood tested and they get urine tested. So a lot of it, 95% of us folks are, a disease happens. There's kids that are getting transplants. And I was a runner, and I was taking perfectly care of my body, and it was sarcoidosis that got me. And it's one of those diseases that pops up, you know, and it could happen to anybody. I was a normal guy, and like I said, I wasn't fit. I wasn't taking a pill, you know, I wasn't taking any medication, but now, thank God, I've got several medications to keep me going. And my recovery has been great. You know, I've gotten back to a point where I take good care of my body. I eat right and take my medicine and exercise. Those three things, you know, and the recovery is seamless. And a lot of these folks that are living donors, the operation is relatively seamless. And those go on, and both of them live perfectly normal lives. And the living donors, those folks are real heroes. I'd tell these kids, and Dr. Breslin can tell this better than I can, about the two parts in your brain that are called the amygdala, and they control empathy and caring. And they say if it's underdeveloped, amygdala, if it's underdeveloped, you could be a sociopath. But if it's overdeveloped, then you're someone special. And you're someone perhaps that would be a living donor. And God bless those folks.
Yeah. Yeah, that's incredible. And I was going to say, to Dave's point too, it's an incredible process, even just to be listed and to be able to qualify as a potential recipient. It's a journey. I'm sure it happened very quickly in your case, but they're very, very careful with the folks that are listed as potential recipients, and it's a whole process in itself. So,
do you also have any sort of message, you know, for the people listening or watching, or just about how important it is? I mean, you see it, right? You live it, and you are in a very difficult field in the healthcare industry.
Yeah. I mean, I would just encourage everyone to have those conversations with their loved ones. It's incredibly important. I think I see a lot of tough, you know, tough conversations to be had with families and loved ones. But it is an incredible option for those of you, for families who think it is a choice. It's an amazing gift. And you can see Dave is living proof of that. And just to be open to it as an option, you know, I think that's the biggest thing, and really having those conversations, because it is really amazing, just both on both ends, and it's the possibility, the fact that it's even a possibility, right? It's mm-hmm. is incredible. And so that would be the biggest thing I just say, to be, you know, be open-minded, but also open-hearted, you know, be able to be selfless and caring and give to others. And that's really, I think, the hope and the message.
All right, great. Well, thank you both so much. It's been an absolute pleasure to get to meet with both of you. The lights keep going off in my office, which I think is a sign that maybe, you know, we're done with this episode and we need to stop talking. But yes, thank you both so much, and really appreciate your time. And, you know, just, of course, one more plug that if people are listening and they're thinking about being an organ donor, make sure you sign up. And, you know, not that it has to be during the month of April, but it is Donate Life Month. So we hope everyone listening will take that into consideration.
Thank you to Dr. Breslin and Dave for joining us to really share some personal, both in the being the recipient of an organ donation, but also personal in going to work every day with Dr. Breslin, you know, having that internal discussion of saving every patient, but knowing when it's time to have a discussion that perhaps could save more people. And I think that's a beautiful story for us to hear and for our listeners to hear, and really just our ability to use this month for awareness of how you can become an organ donor, and the effect that you can have on others, and perhaps the healing, as David said, that our own family members can experience in the midst of a large loss. So if you're going to update those real IDs this month or in the next month, or get your driver's license, check that box, become a donor, have that discussion with your family members, and let your what you would like, your preferences, be known.
Yes, and I'm gonna, you know, have to continue wiping my eyes after that particular episode and conversation. Great information, and I really hope people take it to heart and really, you know, make that decision that's best for them. For other helpful advice, you can always check out Guthrie.org/engage to find out some tips that'll help you all live a healthier lifestyle. Until next time, have a great week, Dr. Johnson.
You too.